Okay, if you would please turn to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11. Now we're still looking at verses 5 through 6. As I said before, they're one sentence in the Greek. And we'll be looking, for the most part, at verse 6 today. I just want to read our text without all the context. Hopefully we have all the context already. And we should be able to wrap this section up today then. Beginning in verse 5 of Hebrews chapter 11. By faith Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith it's impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Now again, we looked at the negative aspect of that statement last week, right? Which was, without faith it is impossible to please him. And today we're going to look at the positive part of that statement. Whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And again, this is a text that many people have done many strange things with. Now there's much here. There's much here if we would put our thoughts on just a few of these words. What I want to do is just recap a few points to bring us back up to speed in this text that we've looked at the last couple weeks so that we can move on with our text here. Enoch was like you and I, we found out, right? He was at one time hostile to God, right? He was hostile to God, then he was regenerate, and then he walked with God. And we saw that walking with God in Scripture is to follow him, his wills, his ways. It's the same as drawing near to him. You can't draw near to him if you're not walking with him. And if you're not walking alongside him, you can't draw near to him, and you can't continue down a road of sin and at the same time be walking with God. That would be an impossibility also. We also saw that without faith, it's impossible to please God, which is like saying without faith, it would be impossible to walk with God. Which we would see that also, right? If we were to read first our John chapter 1, was it verse 12 or 14, where he says it's not by will or by blood, right? We couldn't walk with God if we didn't have faith. We also saw that it's impossible to please him aside from faith. And I know that some grimaced at that last week, but we saw it very clearly in Scriptures, right? That it's an abomination. Whatever you're giving to God, if it's without faith, it's an abomination to him. He not only will not accept it, but he actually hates it. And that even though you may be doing stuff, merit, good stuff, works, it has nothing to do with you being saved. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. So the hardworking community activist that is giving water to people who are thirsty, like remember Christ talked about that, but if they're just a hardworking, you know, community activist giving people water whenever they're thirsty, or visiting people in prison, they're still hated by God if he has no faith. And the Scripture said, the one that gave me food, right, whenever I was hungry, drink whenever I was thirsty, that has to be with faith. Otherwise, it will be an abomination to God. The last part was the negative in the beginning of our text, now the positive. Whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. Now, first we see, it says, whoever would draw near to God. Now, if we stop there, what's he speaking of whenever we say draw near? It'd be the one that walks with him, right? Whoever would walk with him. The one that draws near from him. That would be one then that would be staying away from sin or wickedness or whatever it is, right? The one that is in communion with God or fellowship with God, then he says, must believe that he exists. Well, that would be just about 90% of the people in the world, right, that believe, you know, God exists, whatever that God is. But it says you must believe that he exists. Now, if you notice here, it's curious. The writer does not try to prove the existence of God, does he? He just says you must believe that he exists. And what does Moses say whenever he writes Genesis, the first verse in Genesis? In the beginning, God. Moses doesn't try to prove the existence of God either. He just says in the beginning of God. And the writer here says you must believe that God exists. So he's not trying to convince people of God's existence. He's merely saying, you must believe that he exists. Now remember who's writing here. We're not speaking of just any God, right? We proved that last week, right? If the writer starts mentioning God, do you think he's just talking about God in general up to this point in chapter 11? No. He's already talked to you about God. He's already told you. The one that created the universe. The one that spoke through the prophets in the old days and in these last days has spoken through a son. That God is the God that you must believe exists. So he's not speaking of a God. He's not speaking of some Hindu idea of spirit or enlightenment. He's not speaking of the Native American idea of a great spirit. But the God he is speaking of is the God that he's been speaking of. The God that you must believe that he created everything and he spoke to the prophets. That's the God. Now some equate this statement to whenever Moses asked, whenever Moses says, who shall I say sent me? And then he says, I am. You know, it's that state of being, that state of existence, if you look at that word that way. And so if we look here, we must believe that he exists, the one that's already been spoken of. Okay, we want to make sure that we're zeroed in. It's the God that he's been speaking about, not just any God, as we covered last week. He spoke through the prophets, and now he has spoken through his son. So this is the God that we must believe exists. Not any God, it's got to be this God. So let's think about that a bit. What is it that you must believe then about God? Just off of what it says there. Now we know what he has said about God. And he says, you must believe that he exists. Because you see, here's the thing. Right now, that could be said of demons, right? Okay. They know that God created, right? Okay. We know so far that he's said who God is. He's the creator in Hebrews, right? Okay. Okay. They know that God exists. Okay. They know that he has spoken through the prophets. They know that also. So far, what the writer has talked about God, that he created, that he spoke through the prophets, and in these last days that he spoke through his sons, we would say the demons even believe that. So there must be something more if you're going to draw near to God than just believing that he exists. Because we see here, they know, the demons know in the last days. Remember at Sunday school where it says, who are you, son of God, that you're going, or son of man, that you're going to take us and torment us before the time? So they know that God has even spoken to the son of man. So far, they know the God, the demons would know the God that the writer of the Hebrews has brought forth up until now. But we'll look at that in just a bit. Now, what is it that we can glean from this so far, though, to believe that God exists, the God that the writer of the Hebrews has exposed to us so far, but at the same time, we would say that demons believe those things also. Now, we saw last week that man wants to suppress the truth, right? Whenever we looked at Romans, whenever we saw that without faith, because man wants to suppress the truth for a lie instead. So that no one that draws near to God, they must not suppress the truth then, right? Because we know if we suppress any truth, right, then you're not drawing near to God. You'd be suppressing that. So here's what we would say. Okay, let's just think about it like this. If God created everything like the writer of the Hebrews said that he did, and that's the one that we're supposed to believe in, if we believe that he's creator overall, what does that tell us about that God? Well, it would tell us that he is the most powerful God. To create out of nothing, and he created all, that would be the most powerful God. He didn't have one create him. He existed, right? He exists, okay? And if he created all out of nothing, not only is he the most powerful God, right? But it would also truly be his kingdom, right? What he's made, what he's manufactured, that it would be his. That creation is his. That land is his. All of that is his. So if he is the most powerful God, if he exists and he created everything, then we know he's the most powerful. We know that he would be Lord over everything he created because it's his work of his hands. And we know that all kingdoms have something. They have kings, they have subjects, and they have law also. There's rules to go with all kingdoms, right? Is there any country that doesn't have a law? All kingdoms have law, okay? So just to believe that God exists, the God that the writer of the Hebrews is talking about, we would have to believe that he created all. And the only one that could create all out of nothing would be a most powerful God. And if he created all out of nothing with no help from anybody, with nobody else's okie-dokie, then it's all his. And he's the one that would be allowed to set the standard in the law. Who, what, somebody lesser would say this is how it's going to? No. So we see that. But then we would also see, if that is true, that he exists, that he created all out of nothing, right? That it's his kingdom and he has law. It tells us something else about that God that we must believe in, and that he is sovereign over all. So just to believe that God exists, if we really think about it, it tells us a lot about God. We must believe also that he's sovereign over all. We must believe that he's a sovereign God, that he's a powerful God, that he created, and thereby, because of the creation of his kingdom, of his land, it is his rule that the people must follow. Nope, not a lesser king in the land, right? You'd have to follow his rule. So that brings us to God, and it brings us to his law, that it must be followed. Well, then now we have a problem with some of the people, right? Well, for one thing, we have a problem with the demons. They want to follow that law. We have something there, right? Because many people would believe that. They would say, okay, we see a problem. They do not believe in God the Creator. So some don't do that, right? Some don't see God as a creator. But even if they do, let's just say 60% of the people out there believe that God is a creator. You know what they generally don't believe? They don't believe that he set rule and law in motion within his kingdom. Now then, how did this law come out? How did it come to be? Well, what did he say in Hebrews chapter 1? In the old days, he spoke through prophets. So he spoke through prophets in the last days. He spoke through his son. So our text says, we must believe that he exists and he rewards those who seek him. Okay, so we see it's not just believing in a God that exists. It's going to be that God, the creator. And if he's the creator, he's all these things that we just covered. But if we believe he created and he spoke to the prophets and in these last days through his son, then you know what? He not only exists, but he's active. Now, many believe that God or gas or a God created the world. And then God kind of created it, and then he kind of wound her up and just let her go. And he's removed from creation. A lot of people that believe in God would believe that, that he created, but he's removed, that he's not active. But if God is speaking through to the prophets, if he's providing for creation, which we saw that in Hebrews 1, that he was also providing, if he is... Okay, so he created, right? He speaks to the prophets. He's providing for creation. He said the earth and all that. Remember, all the seasons would come. He's providing for creation. He has set rule and law in place. Curses and reward he's put in place through the prophets, right? I mean, he spoke to the prophets. Okay? And in these last days through his son, then it tells us that he is not only the creator, but he is active within his creation. He's a hands-on God, not a hands-off God. That eliminates a whole lot of people that believe about God right there. So this, if you have faith in God, this should actually be a comfort to us, for people that have faith in God. That the God that created is active, providing for his creation, and he's powerful. That, first of all, he's powerful enough to create, right? But caring enough to provide. Okay, he's powerful enough to create, but he's caring enough to provide. And he's active within his creation. But let us look deeper. Back to our text here. Must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. So now let's think about this. He's not only powerful enough to create. He's not only is he sovereign. Not only is he established so far as being active within his creation, but if you notice there, he's personal also. He's not just active, but now he's personal. Look what it says there. He rewards those who seek him. So you have different thoughts of God out there. That he's aloof, he's not active, he's never personal. And then you have the extreme that only look at him as a personal God, a friend, a boyfriend, a bellboy to meet their needs. And he's both, except for the bellboy part and the boyfriend part. But he's both. The verse here in Hebrew is showing you that he's both. Okay? He's sovereign. He's all-powerful. Right? He has rule and law. And he's active and he's personal and he responds to his creatures. You see what it says there? He rewards those who seek him. He's responding to creatures. So, yes, he's powerful. He's sovereign. He's above all things. But at the same time, he responds to his creatures. He's personal. Whenever you hear people talk about a personal God, a lot of times that's the only God they ever talk about. I wish that we would stress both equally. He is a personal God, but he's a sovereign, powerful God. He's both. That's what this text shows us. He exists, right? And he rewards those that seek him. That's one way of saying that he's powerful, sovereign, and he's personal. So, if we look, he exists, he's active. He's both of these things. Now, if we look at this text, we have a powerful God that exists from all time. Okay? There's none like him. He said that he is the one that creates out of nothing. He sustains his creation, and he responds to their cry, their actions. Yet at the same time, he's powerful. I mean, if you think about that, that's a truly amazing thing just to even try to get a grip on. This God, right? An exceedingly great and powerful God that can create out of nothing. He creates out of nothing. The people that he creates, they turn the truth into a lie. Okay? They suppress the truth. And he, from that day in the garden, speaks of curses and rewards. In these last days, it says he spoke through his son. So he spoke to the prophets. 400 years goes by with no speaking. In these last days, he speaks through his son. It's the same message as the one in the garden in Genesis 3:15. It's the same message of curses and rewards that was spoken then, whenever the people originally traded the truth in for a lie. It's a message of forgiveness and mercy personally for those who by faith draw near to him, and they must believe that he rewards those that seek him. Now, is that two gods? No, we want to make him out to be two gods. Sometimes we look at what we were talking about in prayer this week. You know, people look at the Old Testament God, but then Jesus came around. And whenever I was talking with Angela, it was, well, no. Jesus was around in the Old Testament, right? If we have a proper Orthodox view of Jesus, he was around then. So it wasn't then all of a sudden God changed. If Jesus was there, and if God is perfect, then they're not going to be fighting one another. They're going to be all in one, and there's going to be a tri-unity, right? So it's not even two gods there, and it's not two gods here. This is a God that you have to think of. He exists. He created. He's sovereign. He has rule. It's all his, and we must obey. But at the same time, he hears your cry. He's active in that creation. Here's the cry of people that have sinned against him since the garden. Now, what is it then to seek God? It says we must seek him or draw near to him. Now, there are those... I was speaking to somebody recently. This is a common thing. There are those that say, okay, I've got to seek God. Right? He rewards those that seek him. Those that say, I did this. I drew near to God and he did not reward me. He didn't answer me. As a matter of fact, he turned his back on me in my request. Now, Gerwood and Verkus write this to that comment. Some may not believe that God exists. There are many more who believe that God exists, but who do not believe that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. And then this is what they write. They said, in a crisis, they prayed, and God did not do what they asked of him. Therefore, they conclude that God is at least unresponsive, if not wicked, and they turn away from them, and then this is what they'll tell you, that they know God does not reward those that seek him because they did this, and it didn't happen with them. Here's what they write. Some people could very profitably examine the examples of faith in this chapter. The tenses of the two verbs may help here. They're both participles. Here's what they're talking about. I won't give you the actual Greek. The one who comes, that's one Greek word. And it's a participle. And then those who earnestly seek, that's actually one Greek word also. Again, it's a participle. It's an ing verb. Okay. And they're in present tenses. That means now, doom, keep going. Presently. It's always present. You keep doing it in that sense. Continual. Well, actually, let me read what they say. They're the experts on it. This indicates continual coming and continual seeking. Whenever you read that Hebrews text that says those that draw near and earnestly seek Him, those that are always drawing near and continuing to seek Him all the time, those He rewards. So they write, God does not respond to the occasional seeker. One must keep coming as a lifestyle. One must keep seeking as a regular, habitual, predominant way of life. A single cry never indicates the real nature of the heart. A perpetual cry does. I think he's right. I've told you guys whenever we had the earthquake in Selmar, and the earth, you know, the house is getting all just crumbled up. It's right there by the VA. The VA hospital fell apart. You know, we were just right there by it, and earthquake comes, and we're all shook, of course, out of bed, and you know, glass is breaking, and I mean, it's just, you know. And the house is just tore up. I mean, tore up there, if you remember the Selmar quake. And I remember my mom coming through the hallway, and we're, get in the doorway, you know, because it just keeps on hammering. And I'm like, what do I do? And she said, pray. I didn't really even know what to pray, except I was scared, because I was in my underwear, little boy in my underwear, right? But I was just scared. That was an occasional cry. That wasn't a perpetual thing that I did. That was a single cry that I cried. I didn't know how to pray. I didn't pray. And I didn't pray the following week, the week after that. See, that's what he's talking about here. Who comes to him, not who came and tried, right? It's not that. It's who comes to him and who is earnestly seeking him time and time and time again. In this seeking, we've already seen the seeking is not blind faith, right? No, you must believe that He exists. So it's not just, well, I'm just in search of God, man. I'm just going to go out and see where He is, if He's behind a rock or if I hug a pine tree. No, you must believe that He exists, the God that He's spoken of, and that God you must perpetually, continually be seeking out. It's not a one-time, and here's what, I've seen people do this with this text. It's not a one-time cry. For personal reasons. For some personal tragedy that is going on in your life. I'll prove that in a minute, but hopefully you see that that's not what it is. The Greek is clear. It's a continual, constant pursuit of God. You know, the word for seek here, okay? Where, you know, yours says diligently seek Him. That's actually one word. Okay? Diligently seek Him. I'll just give you a little bit of a lexicon. What does it mean to seek Him? To seek out, to search for diligently, to seek out for oneself or to beg and crave. It's that type of looking. It's that type of a thing that you have to have it. You keep going because your motivation is you crave it, you want it, it's your desire to keep going at that thing. That is to diligently search for it. This is not what most do when something happens bad in their life. And they all of a sudden they pray to God. They're not searching for God. Don't you see it? They're not, are they searching for God? Whenever the earthquake is happening and I'm praying to God, am I searching for God? Or a momentary rest from affliction? Or scared. They're not searching for God. They're not searching about who He is, what He is, the Creator, all those things, right? Okay? They're not searching His ways. They're not searching His law. They're not desiring that. They're not searching His provision, His care, His promises. Right? They're not searching eternal life. They're not searching God that has given His Son to pay the penalty for their sins whenever they're in that state. The Old Testament, you know, without getting too much into detail, where it talks about seeking Him. How many times, I know the teenagers are going through the Psalms. That's in the Psalms. The seeking Him. To seek Him or to draw near to Him is in the Psalms also. That's an Old Testament kind of a thing. And if you read it in the context in the Old Testament, you know the writer Hebrews is always giving us that stuff. If you read it in the Old Testament, it's like God looks down to see those who are seeking Him. It'll say in the Psalms. He looks down to see those who are seeking Him. And what happens is that then He describes sometimes what He's seen or what one that seeks Him would look like. And I love O'Brien. O'Brien says it this way. In the Old Testament, he's just commenting on that idiom, that Hebrew idiom there. He says, whenever it talks about seeking Him, whenever the psalmist talks about seeking Him, right, it speaks of those, he writes, that firmly rely on God, trust that His promises will be fulfilled, and find in Him the source of their deepest satisfaction. That sounds like that seeking thing, doesn't it? That craving, that begging, that's the thing that you're looking for. And then what he said, those that seek Him will be rewarded. Listen to what O'Brien says. That idea of those that seek Him in the Old Testament, those that firmly rely on God, that would be somebody believing in His existence and that He rewards those, trust that His promises will be fulfilled, right? It says also, and they know that those who seek Him, that He will reward them. You see, it fits that Old Testament picture. Speaks of those that firmly rely on God, trust that His promises will be fulfilled, and find in Him the source of their deepest satisfaction. That's the way that term, seek Him, is used in the Old Testament. That's the picture that you see whenever you see it in the Old Testament. Now, the writer of the Hebrews telling us, right, that these people would have rewards, confidence, hope, the different things that they have. Okay. And well, seeking Him is not, and this is how people have used this text. Well, those that seek Him, like I'm seeking out God, you know, seeking the truth. Mom, Dad, I'm leaving, I'm going to go find the truth, or whatever it is, right? It's not that. It's not, well, I'm on a journey to find God, whoever or wherever He is. The text won't allow it. It's a continual searching after the God that they know exists and the God that they know that rewards, the God that has been spoken about in Hebrews. That's the God. It's not just a seeking, like wherever it is, I don't know. Wherever happiness is, I'm just going to roam the earth till it's not that. It's directed, and it's not blind. Now then, it says, He rewards. What rewards is He talking about? How many people will use this for health, wealth, and prosperity verse, right? What rewards is He speaking of here? What's the rewards is the writer speaking of here? He's spoken of, so far in Hebrews, of promises, of brides, of renewal. He's spoken of eternal life, right? He's spoken of sins being taken care of by the high priest in the heavenly tent. He's spoken about those things. He talks about there's no longer a need for sacrifice, and he's getting to that rest, that final thing. But what is the reward? What is the ultimate reward that he is speaking about here? Getting rid of momentary affliction? Well, that wouldn't even fit with Hebrews 10 and all the other stuff. It can't be that. It's not getting out of a jam we prayed about last week. That's not the rewards for those who diligently seek Him. The context won't even allow it. Because what's our context? It's talking about Enoch. Remember, verses 5 and 6 are all one sentence. So what is the reward? Verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. He was not found because God had taken him. Now before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it's impossible to please Him. For whoever would draw near to God, Enoch, must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who seek Him. So the reward is found right there. Enoch being taken up to God. Enoch walked with God. He stepped with Him. By faith he could do so. Without faith he could not have done so, right? And Enoch received his reward, is what the writer is telling us. What was his reward? To be taken up and to be with the Lord, right? So here, Look at verse 6. Whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. So whoever would draw near, whoever would walk with God, whoever would follow God, they must have faith. It's impossible to walk with God apart from faith. But notice something else. He rewards those who seek him. Okay. This personal God answers personally. He rewards those. Not entire nations, not entire countries. He rewards those. Those that seek him. Individuals. Which would make sense. So you have this God that has made everything out of nothing. Yet he knows every hair on your head. And he hears you and he knows who is seeking him and who doesn't. That's a big God. But if you notice here, if you draw near to God in faith, he rewards those who do. That word there, rewards, it's only used here in the Greek Bible. Only here. Now there's some variations of it that we're going to see in a minute. But it's only used here in the Greek Bible. Now I don't know what your margins say. Or if you even have a note in your margins. But O'Brien points out this rewards literally means he is the paymaster. That's what that word means, paymaster. One who pays wages. That's what he is. He is the paymaster. He is the one who pays wages. Now, rewarder or rewards is a fine word as long as you don't narrow it in the range that we might do in America today. If someone wins a lawsuit, they receive an award or a reward. They've been awarded a judgment that states what is due them, and they will receive payment for what is due them. And if you want to use a word like that, I have no problem with it. But if you're doing it rewarding for merit, I have a problem with it then, because sometimes that's the way that we see that word. It means literally a paymaster who pays wages due. So we would say, whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he is the paymaster. He is the one who pays wages due. That would be a literal interpretation of it. Now that should ring a few bells to us if we've been going through Hebrews. Go back to Hebrews chapter 2. We're going to see it used negatively. Like I said, this is just part of the root of that word. That actual word paymaster is just there in the Greek Bible. But here it is in Hebrews 2. It'll be used negatively. Because we see the writer of the Hebrews is keeping his theme alive all the way through. And in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 1, therefore we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away. Isn't that amazing? He has stayed on the same theme. Once he declared who Jesus was in chapter 1, he has been on a thing of warning people to not neglect the salvation that's been given to them. That's what Hebrews 11 is about, right? To strengthen our faith so that we wouldn't. Okay, verse 2. For since the message declared by the angels proved to be reliable and every transgression or disobedience, here we go, received a just retribution. How shall we escape if we neglect such a great... So now he's using it negatively. Every transgression or obedience received a just retribution. Let me try it again. Every sin received payment. That's in the negative. Instead of walking with God by faith, following in God's way by faith, receives payment. Here it is sin. It will be a just payment from the paymaster, as God is called the paymaster there in Hebrews 11:6. I know some of you guys are probably thinking of Romans 6:23, right? The wages of sin is death. Right? The wages due. What do you owe God? Or what will you be paid? Death, if you've sinned. We see that same thing. We see that idea there. Go up to Hebrews chapter 10. We're going to build our way right up to 11:6. So this is going to be right before he starts talking about Enoch. I know that we've read this many times, but I want you to see this theme that is running through. First, the exhortation in verse 23. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how to stir up one another to love and good works, not neglecting to meet together as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. So there's the exhortation. Now the warning, verse 26. For if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sin. What remains? Verse 27. A fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. And let's read something about this judge that is going to give you this fearful expectation. Go down to verse 30. For we know him who said, vengeance is mine, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of a living God. So you see there how God is presented as one, well, negatively in chapter 2, sin will be paid. And then what do we see here? Exhortation, don't do this. Why? Because God will repay. What is God? He's the paymaster. That's why you see our text says rewarder. You can see why they could put it like that. But again, you want to see, you follow the theme. He's a paymaster for those that sin, giving them what is due. And for those that are faithful, now let's look. He goes back and forth. Now look at verse 34. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. Payment, in that sense. So you see, he moves the pay or reward, positive, negative, positive. And now we know that in just a few verses after he's made that statement, he talks about Enoch. And he talks about that he's the paymaster. We see it in both ways. Now then, here's the question. We see that we have this great reward. What is the reward or pay for those that are disobedient or sin? Death, right? The wages of sin is death. The payment is death. What is the reward for those that of faith, what do they receive? What's the reward? Now, if we are children of God through Abraham, we should look to Abraham and to see what Abraham was promised as his reward. In Genesis 15, it says, whenever he meets up with Abraham, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision, fear not, Abraham, I am your shield. Your reward will be very great. And some of your versions may say, your exceedingly great reward. Now, there are a lot of people that say, no. If you look at it properly, it says your reward will be very great. It doesn't say that I am your shield and your exceedingly great reward. Well, you could say that. Some say, no, it's not God that's the reward. The reward is going to be a son. Well, then if we started thinking about it, the reward's going to be a son. And if we go to Galatians, we would see that that son was singular seed, which was Christ, which would go back to God being the reward. I know it's kind of confusing, but either way, I think you'll see it here, though. Listen to Psalm 16:5. The Lord is my chosen portion. My cup, you hold my lot. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance. It's there we see the Lord is the inheritance. The Lord is the reward. The Lord is the chosen portion, the beautiful inheritance. The rewarder is the reward. Which is exactly what the writer was saying about Enoch, was it not? What was the reward that Enoch got? Is to be in the presence of God. What do we have on earth? What did Enoch have the first 65 years of his life? Separation from God. Sin has its payment, which is death, but death how? How is it described? I know we didn't discuss this in Sunday school, but it's described as being apart from God, out of God's presence. That's one of the wages of sin, is to be away from God, outside of his presence. What was Enoch's reward? To be in his presence. So this reward or payment for disobedience, and there's a reward or payment for being faithful. Like Abraham, Enoch, you, me, or whatever. To have the sovereign, powerful God as our Father. To have one that hears, protects, provides, and gives us rest. Now, we see this reward darkly right now, though, right? We have it, but it's dark, right? Let's go to Hebrews 4. You'll see it's a little dark right now. Go to Hebrews 4. The reward or payment from the paymaster for the disobedient is separation from God. Complete and final separation from God. here's the thing. They want separation from God now, right? You go, right? You go to speak to somebody about God, and they say what? I don't want to hear it. And they say that throughout their life. I don't want to hear it. I don't want God. Okay, works for you, as the lady told me this week. Works. I can see it works for you, but I don't want it. Okay? So they're going to have complete separation from God. They have that darkly too. Just like we have the reward of God now, they have that darkly right now too. Right now, they are separated from God. There's a chasm between God and them because of sin. And they cry out. It's the only request of the ungodly that will be answered. They've asked for God to leave them alone. And ultimately, that request will be granted. They will be separated from God as they've always requested. The only request that will ever be met. But we partially have ours. As they partially have what will ultimately be the ultimate separation. They have that darkly now. And then look what we have. We partially have that now ourselves. We partially have our reward. Look at verse 16 in chapter 4. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. You see, we're not with God right now, right? But the separation, the great chasm has been closed. We're not with Him, but we can approach Him right now. And He'll hear us. Go up to chapter 6. You'll see the same thing. Look at chapter 6. You'll see you have a reward. You don't have it yet. But you have it. But it's just darkly. Go up to chapter 6, verse 19. We have this sure and steadfast anchor of the soul. A hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So we have a certain hope of salvation. But the hope for Abraham's reward. Jesus Christ has gone on. He's our priest, and we have assurance. Go up to Hebrews 10 again. We'll look at this again. Hebrews 10, verse 22. Let us draw near with a true heart in full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from the evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. You see, we may not be in the presence of our reward right now, but we have access to Him. We can draw near to Him. We can speak to Him. We can have assurance in Him given by His Spirit. Just as Enoch did. In the same way, right? And then later on we will have that exceedingly great reward in that sense, which will be God realized. Now, think for a minute about our text here in Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11, 5. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had taken him. Now, before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it's impossible to please Him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who seek Him. Now then, you know what we've been doing all since we've been in Hebrews? We keep going back to those wilderness folks, right? That's what he was talking about in chapter 2, right? Where he's talking about being repaid and all that. So let's think about the wilderness folks. Did they walk with God in one sense? Because we've been talking about walking with God, drawing near, believing He exists and all, you know, and He's a rewarder. Okay, so let's just put them through the filter. Did they believe in God in one sense? Well, sure. They followed the fire and the cloud, right? Whenever it moved, it moved. They moved, okay? Okay. And they walked in step with God. Right? We would agree with that, right? We can see something there. You know, metaphorically speaking, they walked in step with God. Okay. Did they believe that He existed? Well, you'd say yes. Did they believe... Now then, remember whenever we looked at His existence, we said this is really... If you're going to believe that He existed the way that the Hebrew writer put Him forth, you'd have to believe certain things about God. Believe in that God. Did they believe that He was powerful, all-powerful, sovereign, and that anything He decreed would happen? Did they believe that, even though they were walking in step with God? No, they did not. They did not believe that. What else did Hebrews say? You have to believe that He's a rewarder of those that seek Him. Did they believe that He was a rewarder of those that seek Him? No, they did not. They believed that the giants of the land would be victorious. And we read that they did not believe the promises of God, which would mean also then, of course, the same thing that we're saying here. The promises that He made to them concerning rest, ultimately they didn't believe it. See, they were walking with God following that fire and that pillar, right? But they weren't walking by faith. Without faith, it's impossible. Please. They did not enter rest because they did not believe the promises. So, did they walk with God step in step following the fire and the cloud? Yes. But by faith? No. Did they believe He existed? Yes. Like so many people today will say that God, a God or whatever, exists. But not as a sovereign, powerful God that would have His decrees happen the way that He decreed it. That they did not believe. They proved that because they said there's no way we can make it into the land. Okay? So did they believe that He was a rewarder of those that seek Him? No. Again, they thought that man on earth, created man, on the other side of the border, that man, the giants, could do away with the God that they believed in. See, they didn't believe in the God that the writer of the Hebrews has been talking about, did they? They walked with God, they followed God, but they didn't believe in that type of a God. And God swore they would not enter His rest. So you must believe that He exists. And if you believe that He exists, you believe that He created. And if He created, it's His world and His kingdom and His rule or rules. The God that they believed in was too small. Little God. He was not sovereign. He was definitely not all-powerful. And He could not reward those who seek Him. It's exactly opposite, you see? He's still, in a sense, alluding to those people, I think. Because they would fail all of these tests. In just that verse 6, they would fail all of it. Enoch had entered his rest. God is the paymaster for disobedience and the paymaster for those that by faith walk with God. So our text tells us about the God that we're supposed to have faith in. That He's sovereign, that He's powerful, that He's the creator, and that if this is His creation, He has right of rule, I'll call it. And He set down rule. And that He has spoken through His prophets about creation, about the right of rule, about His Son. So He's a personal God. He's active. He's personal. If He rewards those that seek Him, meaning He doesn't just look at Crestline, He looks at every single person and He knows who's seeking Him. He hears His people. He leads His subjects. He gives His subjects guidance. And it is only by faith that the subjects can walk in His guidance. Only by faith that they can please God through His Son. And it's not just any God, but the very God the writer of Hebrews has been speaking of. And what is the reward? Hopefully we don't look at this as a health, wealth, and prosperity verse, right? The immediate context doesn't allow it. It's not earthly rewards. It's not momentary relief. It can't be because He's just told the people that they've lost their property in chapter 10. We know it can't be that. Enoch did not get rewards here on earth because he was faithful. It's not why He diligently sought Him in that sense. God rewards those that believe He exists and that believe in His promises that He is a rewarder of those that seek Him. Both promises, the curses and the good stuff, you know. Those are both promises. This indicates whenever we seek Him, it is, again, remember, it is a continual seeking, a continual coming, a continual drawing near. One must keep seeking as a regular, habitual, predominant way of life. Again, the word for seek is seek, to diligently seek, but remember, it's to seek out for oneself, to beg and to crave for that thing. You know, that's what you're doing. Because you want that thing. The thing that you believe exists. The thing that you believe all the things that you believe on, right? And you're looking for that and you're continually pursuing that. That is who God rewards. What did it say in the text? My righteous shall walk by faith. Right? That's what He's talking about. They'll continually do that. Now, listen. I have joy. because I know that many do seek and do crave in this room. Because I talk to you guys during the week all the time. And a lot of times you guys don't talk sports or anything else, but you talk about things that you are diligently seeking and craving for. Right? Enoch has. I know some of you do not do a one-time cry to God. But it's a continual cry. And it's not blind faith either. I can tell you it's not blind faith, but one that truly believes he exists as is written. That God, not the God of our minds, the God that we've carved. Knowing that he is also the paymaster. Yes, we need to look at all of God. He's not just a rewarder, but he's a paymaster for the really bad guys too. Yes, he's all of those things. He rewards those who seek him, no matter if they are giants, demons. He is sovereign. He's powerful. He's personal, and he's active with ears to hear. He has his eyes upon creation. Otherwise, he could not be a rewarder of those that seek him. His eyes are constantly upon us. That's why, remember I said in the Psalms, it said it talked about him looking down to see who was seeking him. Why? Because he's a rewarder of those that seek him. He's personal. He has eyes to see his creation, and he has the heart that rewards those that draw near to him. Let's pray.